I think this is a sign of how special our guest is, because it has never, ever been this quiet when one of us is waiting to start a lecture. Thank you all so much for being here today, and especially to Louise. It's a real honor to be able to introduce her. She has been at Maynooth before, but I suppose from my point of view, this is a much more official visit because it shows how her work has already infiltrated the English department in the space of only 2 years. So thank you so much for coming and for being here. I'm only going to talk for literally 2 minutes because I want to hear Louise and not myself, and as I know you do as well. But I do think it's important to mark her presence here with a proper introduction. So I'm going to actually read something so I don't forget anything. Louise burst onto the literary scene only 2 years ago. That fact actually quite astonishes me when, again, you think about the level of impact her work has made, and it's been felt far and wide, far beyond Ireland, and I think that also says a great deal. She was the recipient of the Irish Book Awards Newcomer of the Year in 2014 for Only Ever Yours, her first novel, which also went on to win the Young Adult Book of the Year in 2015. She's been nominated, among others, for the Waterstones Children's Book Awards, and her second novel, Asking For It, saw her win the Book of the Year at the 2015 Irish Book Awards, which just is spine-tingling. It's really quite an amazing achievement. Louise's work emerged at the same time as a series of other brilliant women novelists in Ireland, from Sarah Baum to Lisa McInerney. But her work has been praised not only for its literary qualities, but also for its significant impact on the discourses of female body image, sexuality, eating disorders, and rape culture. And again, not just in an Irish context, but far beyond. Louise has become a go-to spokesperson for the contemporary Irish feminist movement, appearing on everything from The Late Late Show to articulate for an Irish audience the issues facing young Irish women, and also appearing, as she did only last week, for example, with literary heavyweights like Jeanette Winterson, who was interviewing Louise, just to put that in context, and not the other way around.
Very surreal.
Yeah, absolutely. This is a literary career of a rare kind, one that seems to have tapped into a zeitgeist that it's actually shocking now that it's been articulated, that it hasn't been articulated before. So we're really honored and privileged that Louise has taken time out of a genuinely busy schedule to come and talk to us today. So you're very welcome.
I always wish that like my parents were here when I hear those sort of introductions. I'm like, I'm so amazing. It's incredible. Yeah, I was out on Saturday Night and I met this guy and he was like, oh, what's your name? And I was like, oh, Louise O'Neill. I was very drunk at this stage. And he was like, oh, what do you do? And I was like, wait, you haven't heard of me? I'm like really important. And I was like, oh my God. So the next day when you wake up, you're like, I can't. Anyway, it's fine. Yeah, so this is my first novel, Only Ever Yours. I'm going to do a reading from this, which should be fun because I haven't read from it in a while. It's actually, at the moment, they're in production to make a movie out of it, and the movie producer keeps ringing me and asking me questions about it. I haven't read it in about 2 years, and I'm like, yeah, I know what you're talking about. She's like, how about this character? I'm like, I have no idea what she, honestly, I have no idea what she's on about half the time. But anyway, it's set in a dystopian world in which women are unable to have daughters. They can have sons, but their bodies have naturally evolved to reject a female fetus in the womb. So faced with the extinction of the human race, these schools are set up in which girls are genetically modified, bred for their beauty, and then trained to be subservient to men. And on their 17th birthday, they go through a ceremony after which they're divided into three categories. So they can either become companions, and the companions are the wives to the wealthy men, and they're responsible for bearing the sons. They can become concubines, and the concubines are in charge of the sexual needs of the men. Or they can become chastities, and the chastities are the nun-like figures that run the schools. So it's about a girl called Frida, and just I think it's really more to do with her, how she's coping because she's in final year and the prospect of a very uncertain future lying ahead, and her friendship with her best friend Isabel is slowly disintegrating. So I'm going to read you a passage, and then I hope you have loads of questions for me. We are wound up and wound down like mechanical dolls. They turn the lamps on, they turn the lamps off, and another day is done. I wish I could just stop time until I'm ready. I told Isabel some night last year when neither of us could sleep. We sat on the floor in her cubicle, our backs against the mirrored wall, legs stretched out in front of us. And I tried not to compare the size of my thigh gap with hers. Do you ever feel like that? No, she said, and I felt illogically betrayed. I pulled away from her a little, loneliness burying itself deep within me, and she shifted closer, refusing to allow me to sulk. Don't worry about the future, she said. Things are only going to get better. I promise. She promised me. The dorms are hazy with steam tonight. It's crawling into my mouth, gathering in the back of my throat. I need to breathe. I pause by Isabel's room on my way out of the dorms, see her platinum hair spilling over the pillows. It's been a long time since she has come into my room at night. I follow the floor tiles, black to white, black to white, until I reach the cloisters, walking the long nave with its curved window frames on either wall, each one sealed up to block out the dead outside. The windows are covered with giant paintings, seven on each side, all depicting images from life before us. The Empire State Building, the Grand Canyon, the Great Wall of China, the pyramids, the Colosseum, the Taj Mahal. I imagine them now, baking like clay in the blistering heat. Or maybe they're swimming underneath the great ocean, only fish bones left to keep them company. The others think it's weird that I love watching the Nature Channel to see what the world was like before us. They don't understand why I would want to know about the life cycle of frogs or watch the sea roaring, throwing its spittle onto thousands of grains of sand. Fields of corn waving in the breeze, mountains capped in glittering ice, millions and millions of people living in the big cities, all performing their part in an intricate dance, weaving in and around each other unthinkingly. The only nature they show us in class is in the authorized destruction series, the ice melting, the seas reconciling their differences and drowning the doomed low-lying countries, never to be seen again. There was relief at first, the hope that they had found an organic solution to the population crisis, but that soon turned to fear. The remaining people moving inward and inward and inward until the zones were formed to protect the remaining few from the scalding sun and the rising waters, the NOAA Project. Two by two, the humans entered, all marching forward to create a new world. They got rid of anything we would not need, like animals and organized religion. They got rid of anything that would weigh us down. I reached the giant wooden doors guarding the entrance, each one engraved with the white, red and black triangles of the triquetra. I twist the brass handle to release them, my sweating hands slipping, leaving a mucus-like residue behind. The gates stand sentinel next, rusty metal arches reaching into spikes, waiting for intruders that will never come. In the garden, I walk along the circular concrete path looping our living quarters, stepping off the path into the grass, the synthetic blades scratching my bare feet as I weave my way around the army of trees. Each one is positioned at an equal distance from the next, their plastic limbs extending into painted leaves embellished with crystals, stuffed birds glued on like feathered tumours. I think of the videos on the Nature Channel, of the vast orchards in old England, the gnarled branches heavy with natural food. They must be dead now, those trees. Dead, like everything else. Rotted away, decaying like female babies in the uterus, decomposing from the inside out. You are fortunate, Chastity Ruth told us as we were formally inducted into the school in fourth year. I still remember how strange the new clothes felt, how heavy my lips were with the coating of unfamiliar lipstick. We were in the hall, watching as she gave her speech on the stage, our bodies so little they were nearly consumed by the cushioned velvet seats. Fortunate, she repeated sternly. I pulled down the cropped t-shirt with glittery lips embroidered on it, the gap between it and the new denim hot pants too bare for comfort. And her lip turned up in a snarl when she saw me fidgeting, her eyes fierce. And I felt afraid for the first time. And then she showed us the video. The infamous girl graves. Thousands of unwanted daughters disposed of in an ever-expanding hole, their heads crushing against each other like broken china dolls. Drugstores with shelves upon shelves stacked with gender-specific fertility drugs, as easy to buy as chewing gum. And the body learned. It learned that a female baby was an invader, come to steal her mother's beauty. It learned that a female baby was dangerous. So I had the idea for Only Ever Yours when I was in New York. I moved there when I was 25 to intern for the senior style director of Elle magazine. Which seemed like, obviously it was an incredible opportunity, but I had had anorexia and bulimia as a teenager. And the night before I left, my mother was like, Are you sure this is a good idea? And I was like, what could possibly go wrong? And within about a week of working there, I had started to sort of restrict my food and I was starting to really lose weight. And I went home at Christmas and I'd lost 2 stone in sort of about 2.5 months. And my parents were obviously really worried and, you know, they kept saying to me, are you sure you're okay? You know, you're clearly not well. And I was like, I don't know what you're talking about. Everyone in the office is telling me I look amazing because I can fit into all the sample sizes, which is really worrying when you think about someone who's, you know, in the throes of severe anorexia can fit into the sizes that we're encouraged to sort of emulate. But and my dad dropped me back to the airport and he asked me on the way, he said, you know, are you happy? And he asked it in such a way that I didn't even have a chance to sort of come up with a, yeah, I'm great, everything's amazing. And I just said, no. And he said, well, why aren't you happy? What can you do to change it? And I said, look, I want to write. I just don't feel like I'm fulfilled by this career. I don't feel like this is the industry in which I want to work. And he was like, well, you know, you should get up early. You should, you know, write on the subway. I was like, on the subway, I'm trying to pretend I don't see any pregnant people in case they make me give them my seat. So I'm just, no, I can't see you. I know you're 9 months pregnant, it's fine. And anyway, so it was, I think I'd been back, it was January, I'd been back for about 2 weeks and the weather was so bad that the subway had broken down. And I was sitting in a Starbucks, where all dreams begin, obviously. And I was reading this really trashy magazine, I think it was like US Weekly or something. And there was this woman sitting next to me and she was eating a muffin and I was nearly fixated on her because I was so jealous, I think, of the fact that she could just have this muffin and not sort of have an existential crisis about what that meant about her as a human being. And she probably was slightly unnerved at this girl just being like, look at you, girl, you go. So I went back to my magazine anyway, and all of a sudden, and the only way I can describe it, it was like a vision, the first non-drug-induced vision I've ever had, and I haven't had one since. But and it was of a room, actually very similar to this, sort of tiered seating, and there was a girl standing in the front, and she was in her bikini, and there was a nun-like figure circling her with a red marker in her hand, and she was drawing circles around sort of defective body parts, while all the other girls in the classroom were banging their fists off the table and chanting fat, fat, fat. And it was such an incredibly vivid image. And, you know, I always carry a notebook sort of for the hope that the idea for a novel would come. And I grabbed the book and I just started writing. And I had an entire notebook full by when I finished, and I just sort of put it away because I felt like it seemed very angry and very unhappy, and I didn't really want to think that I was either of those things. But I, you know, the anorexia became too just too bad to ignore, really. And I was getting a lot of chest pains, and I went to the doctor, and they were like, you know, you're kind of about to have a heart attack. And I was like, oh, I better take this seriously. So I started seeing a therapist while I was there. And I think it's a really interesting experience recovering from, you know, a life-threatening eating disorder while you're working in an industry that completely fetishizes extreme thinness and is obsessed with the commodification of the female body. And I do think that played into my desire by the time that I left New York, because I was really working with that, sort of trying to figure out who I was as a person, who I was as a woman, what did feminism mean to me, what did being a woman in a patriarchal society mean. And I just felt like I couldn't continue working in an industry that I felt had contributed not only to my own illness, but to a culture that was making women sick. So I went home to start writing the book. And I was a little bit concerned at the start because I was like, oh, it's dystopian, and dystopian's really, you know, the market's really saturated. And if I have to hear another story of in a world where, you're just like, oh, God. So I tried to write another book. When I say tried to write, I mean, I was in my pajamas watching, you know, One Direction videos all the time. My parents would come home going, how's it going? I'm like, great, it's going really well. And then on my 27th birthday, I woke up that morning, they bought me a laptop with Word installed. And my mom was like, you know, for your novel. And I was like, shit, they really expect me to actually write this. So about a week later, I started writing Only Ever Yours. And it was just the oddest experience because I feel like sometimes as if I nearly channeled it, because it just, I never had writer's block. I didn't have a clue when I started, sort of, I knew how it was going to end, and I had all these different scenes that I wanted to include, but I didn't really have like well sort of structured or anything like that. I just let it just come from somewhere. And it was weird. Like when I was editing it, there was like entire sections of it that I had no recollection of writing. So unless my dad was sneaking into my room and having it all go, hopefully he wasn't, but and you know, it's funny because I suppose when, you know, I was writing, I didn't show it to anybody. I didn't have any idea whether it was any good. And I remember a friend saying to me midway through, I'd say I was maybe at 40 or 50,000 words, and she said, you know, well, what do you like, how's it going? And I said, I honestly think that if I get this right, I said, I think this book could be really important. And I've never seen anyone look so like trying not to, like, you know, roll their eyes at me, like, oh, sure. And I was like, it wasn't that I thought I was the best writer. I just thought there was something in the book that I needed to hear, and that I felt that if I needed to hear it, and if I needed to, you know, I suppose, process all of that, then there would definitely be other women and other men who would need to as well. So I started, I finished, I'd given myself a deadline. I came home from New York the 1st of September. And I gave myself a deadline of a year and actually finished it the 31st of August. So it was like right within the year. And I kind of left it alone for a month and then started editing it. And then as soon as I sent it out, there was such a strong reaction at agent level. Like I sent it out to, I think, about 25, and within a week, in the UK and in New York. And then within a week, I'd heard back from 16 agents saying that they wanted to read the full manuscript. And then kind of within a couple of months, I went over to meet sort of like six of the most prestigious agents in London. You know, you're talking, you know, John Banville's agent and J.K. Rowling's agent, and, you know, and I had offers of representation from five. And it's weird because I think with everything with my writing career, I've just gone completely on instinct. So I ended up choosing the youngest and the least experienced of all the agents just because I liked her the best. And I did the exact same with my editor. So I was 28, my editor was 30, and my agent was 26. I was 28 and my editor was 30. So we were all really, I think, hungry. Felt very ambitious, and it's been really exciting, I think, for the three of us, because I feel like this has been our big break together, which is really nice. So again, before I came out, they kept, you know, there was this sort of feeling of, you know, just manage your expectations. And I don't know, I just felt there was something in it that if people read it, that they would respond to it. And it's been really gratifying with this book. I have to say, with Asking For It, which came out in September, I didn't know what to expect, actually, because I was much more nervous about that book, because it was, I think with Only Ever Yours, that just seemed to flow, whereas Asking For It was an incredibly difficult book to write. When I finished, I genuinely didn't think I would ever be able to write a book again. Just because, you know, I suppose maybe it's the way I approach writing as well. I wanted to be an actress as a teenager. And I think the way that I approach writing is kind of similar. Like, I really try and create that world. And then it takes about 6 months, writing 7 days a week, to get the first draft done. And I barely go out. Like, I barely wash my hair. Very attractive. I give up dating and drinking. And those are my two favorite things to do. So very focused. And I suppose I kind of try and take on the character. As you can imagine, because I always move in with my parents when I'm writing, they find that really enjoyable. They're like, why are you acting like a 16-year-old? I didn't ask to be born. I hate you. But with Asking For It, I think at the start it was okay. And then I was doing all this research and I was reading, you know, and meeting survivors of sexual violence. Sorry, for anyone who hasn't read it, can leave now, but it's set in a small town in West Cork, and it's about an 18-year-old girl called Emma, and she's sort of the queen bee of her social set and has the world at her feet. And one night she goes to a party, and she gets drunk and takes MDMA, and she wakes up the next day and she's been thrown on the front porch of her house, and she's no recollection of how she got there. And it's when pictures start emerging on social media that she can piece together that she was brutally gang raped the night before. And very cheerful, I know. And I suppose it's really about victim blaming and how the small community in which she lives really react to it, and the impact that has on her and her family. So in order to do that, because, you know, Only Ever Yours obviously is dystopian, so I could just completely make everything up. But with Asking For It, I wanted it to be really, really authentic, and I wanted to make sure that it felt very true to life. So I spoke to a lot of survivors of sexual violence, and I went to the Rape Crisis Centre, and I was, you know, speaking to barristers and reading first-person narratives and memoirs. So I was so, I think, just really engrossed in it, I suppose, that it, you know, I was having nightmares about being raped, and it was from the very beginning, actually, because I had to tell my parents and my sister that I had been sexually assaulted when I was 19, because I knew that was going to come up in interviews. So I had told them maybe 2 days before I started writing. So from the very beginning of starting to write the book, it was just this very emotional, quite upsetting process. So I really felt very unsure about it. I know both my editor and my agent were like, this is going to be a really big book. My publisher was really sure about it as well. I felt really nervous, actually. I wasn't sure. I could see on Twitter that other people who were speaking out about rape culture, the sort of abuse that they were getting. And I was a little bit worried if that was going to be directed at me, which it was eventually. But it's been really, like, it was released in September, and it's been a very strange experience ever since, actually, because, you know, not only, I suppose, was it just covered extensively, and, you know, there was a lot of media attention for it, which is always a little bit strange, because, you know, you go and you do these interviews, and, you know, you might be talking to someone for an hour and a half, and then you come out and you read, like, you know, they'll take quotes out of context, and that is actually a thing. I just thought Hollywood stars were making that up. Like, that does happen. And so that was a little bit odd. And then every day since it's been published, every single day, not a day goes by that I don't get an email from a woman wanting to, no men actually, but just from women, wanting to share their stories of rape, abuse, sexual violence, and talking about how that the book has helped them, or that the book has had an impact upon them. And, like, that's incredibly gratifying, because as a writer, you know, to feel like you're affecting people in that way is very humbling. But also, you know, I'm just a story. Like, I just told a story. I don't have any, I'm not a trained therapist. So it's difficult, I suppose, to know how to try and get the balance between the two of those. But, you know, it's a journey. I'm doing it. It's been very surreal, actually, because I just turned 31, and it was very odd thinking on my birthday just last week, wow, I got that laptop 4 years ago. And could I have imagined all of this? I mean, obviously I hoped, you know, that it would do really well, but, you know, with the movie deal and with everything else, it just seems to be every day that something new happens. And it is very surreal, because I think people always want to know, what does it feel like, or what does it feel like when all of your dreams have come true? And in a lot of ways, it's like I feel the exact same as I did 4 years ago. Some days it feels like it's happening to someone else. You know, you're talking about things, and it's very surreal. As a writer, I'm being really articulate now. I'm just like, I feel really lucky and very fortunate. Like, it's wonderful to be invited to something like this today and to be able to speak to you, because it wasn't that long ago since I was in your, not that long ago at all.